Welcome to Halacha in a Year, where we can get to learn all the most relevant halacha through the prism of the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch. You are listening to Rabbi Yaakov Tramp. This shiur is kindly sponsored by the Moshe Group and CA in Zuchus of Rivka Bela Bas Nechama Shifra and in honor of Rabbi Tramp.
Halachas we're going to be learning about are the halachas of Pas Yisrael, Bishul Yisrael, and Chalav Yisrael. This is Siman Lamed Tes, the 39th chapter in the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch. Just to give it a bit of a background to what we're addressing, and then we'll jump straight in, is that Chazal instituted a number of decrees of takonas which surround food. And that means to say, when a Jew eats, it's not only about the ingredients, there are also ordinances in certain different realms of food eating which need to be carefully assessed. You have certain boundaries which should prevent the nation of Israel from eating with non-Jews. And we're going to examine 2/3 of those. The first is what's called Bishul Akum that we're going to address today, which is food which is cooked by a non-Jew. The second is Pas Akum, which is bread which is baked by a non-Jew. And the third is Chalav Akum, that is milk which is milked by a non-Jew. Let's jump straight in right now. So the background to these decrees is that these decrees were instituted in order to ensure that Jews and non-Jews remain separate, because one of the most homogenizing, one of the greatest places to converge and is through the socialization which happens around food. And therefore, in an effort to preserve the uniqueness of the Jewish people, that they're not going to intermarry and assimilate into the nations around them, there were certain ordinances made about their food eating, about how they eat and where they eat. And one of them is that any food which is cooked by a non-Jew may not be eaten. There are two primary concerns. One is the social concern of chasnas, which is intermarriage, and the other is kashrus concerns, because food is cooked by a non-Jew without oversight, to them many of the laws of kashrus don't make a lot of sense. So a little bit here, a little bit there, doesn't really matter to them, but it certainly matters to us. So those are two aspects of it. We're going to look at the section of Bishul Akum through the prism of 14 basic questions. Question number one is, are all foods cooked by non-Jews a problem of Bishul Akum? So the truth is, not really. Not all food cooked by a non-Jew is a problem. It's only a food that meets the following two criteria. It needs to, first of all, be a food that, were it not for cooking, it could not be eaten raw. That means the cooking is making a very important impact and change on the item. And number two, it is the type of dish which can be served in front of a king, which means, say, it's an honorable dish. It's not something which is scant, which is not necessarily honorable. So what's an example of something that could not be eaten raw or could be eaten raw? So as an example, could not be eaten raw, generally speaking, is meat. Meat, we assume, is something which needs cooking for transformation. And some things which could be eaten raw, things like, let's say, many vegetables, carrots as an example, fruits, certainly, or even water. Water can be drunk raw and it can be cooked and drunk in such a state. What is an example of something which is worthy of a king's table or not? So something which is fit for a king's table, something like soup as an example, but not fit for the king's table, would be oatmeal, toasted cheese sandwiches. Those type of things are not subject to the prohibition of Bishul Akum. So isn't this a little bit subjective? The answer is, it's subjective, but subjective to era, not person by person. So it's not up to whether I decide whether this is fit for the king or whether I could eat it raw, but it's about subjective to the age, because there's certain eras in which certain foods are eaten raw or not eaten raw. As an example, fish may depend on locale. So in Japan, many things are eaten raw, including fish, but in many places, fish is not eaten raw and therefore would be subject to Bishul Akum in this respect as well. How does one avoid this issue? So in order to avoid Bishul Akum, the Jew must be involved in either lighting the fire or putting the dish into the oven, onto the stove, in such a way that they're involved in the cooking process. That would ameliorate the concern of Bishul Akum. What happens if the non-Jew is working in a Jewish house and is cooking in their house? This is still an issue of Bishul Akum. Wait a second, so how does that work with a non-Jewish help? If there's a person who's in the house, who's helping with the household chores, and they're going to be cooking, how does that work? So in the old days, when the fire was a fire which was made of, a real fire with logs, and then this was less of an issue because you could see occasionally throughout the course of the day, the Jewish owner of the house would be walking through and throw a twig in and be involved in this. However, today, with our mechanized ovens and our stoves, it really is an issue, unless the Jew is the one who switches on the oven or sets the timer to switch on at a certain time. Non-Jewish help in the kitchen should really be given the instructions that they do not have carte blanche. They are only allowed to cook things when they're given direction to, or when the oven is switched on by the Jew. It needs to be very careful because these kind of mistakes happen and it has severe consequences. What happens if this person, this household, is just cooking for themselves? In this case, there's more of a concern because, and it should not be allowed in a Jewish kitchen, because they will be less concerned about the kashrus and may add ingredients which are not kosher altogether, and they would say to themselves, it's not an issue because it's not for me. So it's not for the Jew, it's for me. And therefore, this has to be very careful about this as well. It's better to have a policy that they may eat anything in the house, but not cook. Or if they are cooking, only ingredients from the house, and the Jew has to be the one to switch on the oven always. So it requires an important policy in terms of household. Most people are very unaware of this aspect of cooking when it comes to Jews and non-Jews. What if the non-Jew did cook something but did not use a non-kosher ingredient? So they only use kosher ingredients, but they cooked. In that case, this most people do not know. It becomes treif. The pot, it becomes treif and needs kashering as well. So even though the ingredients are completely kosher, Bishul Akum is a superimposed ordinance which renders the pots treif. Right? So this is very significant. And that's why you can't play games with this, which means that you can't just say, oh, it happened. If it happened, that means you need to kash everything. It's a very significant concern. It's a very significant concern in restaurants. These are very important things. If the oven goes off, many kashrus agencies have requirements that there are pilot lights that remain on in the stoves. A lot of stoves these days, ovens don't have pilot lights. Because a pilot light, maybe one can rely on that if the Jew switched that on in the beginning. Very, very complicated halachas. What if a Jew was enlisted to cook for a seriously ill Jew on Shabbos? So in that case, let's say a person is dangerously ill, they need food. You can tell a non-Jew to cook for them. No problem in this case, if a person's in a case of pikuach nefesh or safek pikuach nefesh. However, after Shabbos, then the right after Motzei Shabbos, then no one can eat that food, including the patient, if there's somebody else who can make food then, because it's no longer necessary to use that food. And the pot would be mutter after 24 hours in that case. The next question, is cooking an egg included in this? The answer is yes, even though technically one can swallow an egg raw, and some people do, but generally wide practice is not such. What about unripe fruit? So generally speaking, since I can eat a fruit raw, therefore it's not there is no Bishul Akum issue. But if it's unripe fruit, which sometimes is cooked, then that would be a concern about Bishul Akum. What about beer? So generally speaking, we view beer as fermented barley in water. So we consider the water the mainstay and just with seasoning or flavoring. The water is not subject to Bishul Akum, therefore it's fine. This is not true if there are traces of wine, because non-Jewish wine is a separate ordinance, which we'll deal with at another point. Stam Yenom, which has more complex prohibitions relating to it as well. And what about, that would be sherry casks and other things like that, more complicated issues. What about coffee, tea, or hot chocolate? So technically speaking, again, it's considered like flavored water, and water is not subject to Bishul Akum in this case. If chalav akum, if non-Jewish milk is added, of course, that's going to be a separate problem in just a moment. The Kisser suggests that drinking these drinks in a home or the place of the non-Jew should be avoided. Unless it's ba'akra, I mean to say a person's taking it from time to time or taking it on the road and it's not about sitting together, then that would be allowed as well. Certainly in a place where there are many Jewish coffee shops, then one should not have to rely on this as well. What type of cooking is excluded? So one of the excluded forms of cooking is smoking. Smoking is not included in Bishul Akum, so if the form of cooking was not cooking regularly but was smoking, is an issue. Roasting is a problem of Bishul Akum. Okay. Obviously, lots more halachas that need to be examined, but this is, I find, is one of the most underappreciated, unknown aspects of kashrus, and this has a significant impact on restaurants. Restaurants need to have a mashgiach from the very beginning of the day to be involved in, first of all, switching on the oven. The oven needs to have keys, usually to be able to switch it on, and if it goes out in the middle of the day, then the mashgiach needs to be there. This requires a significant amount of work to ensure that this happens, and most people just walk into restaurants and think everything is fine. That's why you need to have a good kashrus agencies. Now, the second concept is Pas Akum or Pas Yisrael. What is this? This is another takana, another ordinance which was made, that bread which is baked by a non-Jew, even if all the ingredients are kosher, is prohibited as well. It turns out that this particular takana was not accepted by all of Israel, and as such, it is not enforced in the same way as others. The Kitzur frames it that the default is that we should try to keep Pas Yisrael, but in certain cases we can rely on it, of course, if it's kosher bread, which is produced by a non-Jew. We'll see in just a moment. So let's do a few questions to understand this. We can look at 9 basic questions. What types of breads are included in this Isser? So the only breads that are included are the ones which are produced from the 5 grains, which excludes cornbread or rice bread. They are not included in the Pas Akum situation. Now, question number 2, how would a Jew ensure that the bread is not Pas Akum? So, if a Jew would be involved in the baking process, whether adding fuel to the fire, putting the bread into the oven, that would be sufficient. When can I buy Pas Akum? So, let's say a person is at a Shas Adachak, there's pressure, there's no other bread available, or one is traveling, and there's no Pas Yisrael available within 2.5 miles ahead of one may purchase Pas Akum. Any Pas Akum is allowed? No. It's only bread which is made by a non-Jewish bakery with a hechsher. So, for instance, like in America, as an example, Dutch County is a non-Jewish bread which has got an OU kosher symbol on it. So the ingredients are all kosher, but it's not Pas Yisrael. That means to say there was not a Jew involved in the cooking process, but it is kosher. So that's Pas Akum, what's called Pas Palta, because it's from a non-Jewish bakery. That is fine. However, a non-Jew cooks themselves, even if it's cooked and totally kosher, that would be a problem. One could not benefit from them as well in that case. What if he's baking it to sell it? So if this is a person who's got like their kitchen and they bake to sell, that's considered a baker. And if a person is a baker but he cooks for his personal family, that is considered a Pas Akum and should be avoided in this case, even under pressure. What if there's no non-Jewish bakery whatsoever? So in this case, the greatest amount of Shas HaDechak, the greatest amount of Shas HaDechak, then if one can ascertain the kashrus, one would be allowed to buy even from a non-Jew who made the bread if it's kosher. Very hard to ascertain that if one does not have a kashrus agency. What about bread with egg paste on it? So that's a separate problem because the egg paste on the bread is a concern of Bishul Akum, independent of the Pas Akum as well. What if a Jew gives their dough to a non-Jewish baker to bake? This is very common in the times when Jews did not have ovens or ovens were not so easy, so people bring their dough to other people to bake. What happens to the person they're bringing it to bake is a non-Jew? In that case, the Kitzur says that's even worse than a non-Jew cooking their bread for a Jew, because in this case, just find a Jewish baker, and therefore there's no kulos, there's no exceptions allowed in this case. Finally, last question, is it a good thing to be machmir? So in a developed Jewish community, where there are many Jewish bakeries, many kosher bakeries which are Pas Yisrael, it's hard to excuse buying bread which is Pas Palta. Pas Palta is which is non-Jewish created bread, even though it's kosher. Sometimes it's breads which are not available through the kosher bakeries, which is then a reason people maybe make all that case. They say it's a health bread which the person has sensitivities to, and then the kosher bakery is not producing it. But barring that, for the vast majority of people who are buying in the same town, and they have kosher bakeries, they should certainly fraternize with the kosher bakeries, thereby keeping this takana, as the Kitzur says, this is the default that one should be doing. When one has to travel, then one can rely on the Pas Palta as well. It's worthwhile noting that this is one of the examples the Shulchan Aruch gives, that when one is in the Aseres Yemei Teshuva, one should take on this idea of only eating Pas Yisrael, certainly for the very least for the Aseres Yemei Teshuva as well. We now move into our last halacha of today, our last concept, which is the notion of Chalav Yisrael, Chalav Akum, and that is the decree that that milk which is milked by a non-Jew, and cheese which is made by a non-Jew, that's actually Gvinas Akum, these particular gzeros, again, with the concern of fraternization, the concern for foreign ingredients or milk from non-kosher animals being added, are again in motion. We're going to look at 10 basic questions. Question number 1 is, what makes something Chalav Akum? So Chalav Akum is milk which is milked by a non-Jew when they're not in the presence of a Jew. So we don't know what could have been in there. How could it be made that the milk is Chalav Yisrael? It needs to be that the Jew is there at the beginning of the process and also looks in the kelim, in the vessels, to ensure that no other milk or no other types of milk was there to start with. What if the milking is done by a non-Jew in the premises of a Jew? So it's a Jewish cow, Jewish-owned cow, on the Jewish premises, but the non-Jew is doing the work. So it depends. The Kitzur says, if there's no other interrupting house, so between the Jewish house and where the milking is going on, so therefore there's oversight, the person would be scared to perhaps supplant or add other milk, then that would be all right. However, if there is, you know, some sort of interruption in view, so there's a non-Jewish house between, then they perhaps have reason that they could add in other cheaper milk and supplant with the kosher milk to make a shortcut. how old does the person doing the overseeing need to be? So it isn't dramatically old. It can even be 9-year-old boy or girl who's responsible enough to would be sufficient to create the oversight necessary for Chalav Yisrael as well. Remembering that when we're paying for Chalav Yisrael milk, we're paying a little extra because we're paying for the extra level of oversight which is necessary. But today I see many people who are drinking regular milk from non-Jewish companies with an OU or a kasher symbol on it. So very famous here of Moshe Feinstein Paskin that in the USA, where the, in the United States of America, where the FDA regulates and sets penalties for companies which would be using non-cow milk or outside the regulations, he believes that that is sufficient, mirsas, that's a sufficient oversight necessary which would create the Chalav Yisrael without necessarily being overseen by a Jew at the milking stage as well. He does point out that a Baal Nefesh should be machmer, not to rely on this. And if a person is going to the store and they're side by side, Chalav Yisrael and regular milk, a person should get a Chalav Yisrael milk. It's much simpler to in the situation. Also, a person should be careful. This is not a universal halacha that Rav Moshe is talking about. It depends on the country. So in America, where there is significant regulations on foods, then yes, that would make sense. Not all countries that way. And if a person is traveling, they cannot rely on Rav Moshe and go to the regular store there and get a milk. One would have to ask a question about their country. Many countries do not have as stringent regulations as America. Question number 6, what about cheese made by a non-Jew with milked from made by a Jew which from milked by a non-Jew? So this is still an issue because the milk itself is chalav akum. What about cheese made by from milked by a Jew, but it is made by a non-Jew? That's called gvinas akum, made by the cheese of a non-Jew, even though the milk itself is good. How can this be rectified? So gvinas Yisrael is only if the cheese-making process itself is under Jewish oversight, and that is much more complicated to get to. There's no more kulas in this particular case. Rav Moshe's kula does not apply to the regulations of cheese-making, which is not the same as when it comes to production of milk as well. There's a lot to read on this particular and very fascinating topic. What about butter? So the Kisser records that there's a dispute whether chemas akum, whether the butter made by a non-Jew is allowed, and one should follow the custom of their place, because some say that butter will not curdle with non-kosher animals' milk. However, there are those who are machmir. The Kisser points out that there was a scandal during the times that he was aware of it, that Rav Gansfried was aware of it, where the law, where the butter was used on containers which were smeared with lard, which is from pigs, and therefore because of this, he said it's important, because all these kinds of mistakes happen, a person should be very careful when it comes to chemas akum, the butter of a non-Jew. These are all complicated halachas which require oversight and questions. So a person needs to ask these questions specifically when traveling, when one's not necessarily in a place where kosher is so pervasive and available. And with this, we're going to conclude the very fascinating halachas of diet. Have a wonderful.